What we have in front of us is the Mishnah at the beginning of Brachot. And the Mishnah itself is written in what language, Rabosai?
Hebrew.
Hebrew. So that's the most fundamental difference between the Mishnah and the Gemara. Again, there are historical differences. The Mishnah predates the Gemara by quite a bit of time, but that's not what I was pointing out. I'm emphasizing just that in terms of the text, the language of the Mishnah is radically different from the Gemara. Now, this is going to be very helpful when we learn Gemara, because very often the Gemara is going to quote the Mishnah, and then it'll make a comment on the Mishnah, and you don't know where to punctuate. You know, when does the Mishnah end, and when does the Gemara begin? And the best barometer, you know, if you want to put your finger on the pulse, is a shift in language. Whereas the Mishnah is written in Hebrew, Lashon Kodesh, the Gemara is written in Aramaic. So as soon as you can, as soon as you can sense that change in the language, you know that you're finished with the Mishnah and you're ready for the Gemara. Now, in the printed Talmud, what they do is they take the first word of the Mishnah and they put it into a big box and they expand the font. And part of the reason for that is in order to give you an association with the name of that chapter. So the name of the chapter that we're learning, and that's usually the case, is in the big box. And that's called Me'emasai, or in Havarat Sfaradit, Me'ematai. Okay? Whichever you prefer. Yeah, I'm from the old school, that's why I'm used to the way I was brought up, so I say it in Ashkenazis. But if it throws you for a loop, just tell me and I'll quickly shift to the other way. So Me'emasai. Now, what is the subject of Masechet Brachot that we're learning? There are basically four subjects. Number one is Kriyat Shema. Okay? Number two is Tfilah. Number three is Birchot HaNe'nim, which means the bracha that you make before you eat something or before you enjoy some sort of benefit. And number four, another category of brachot, which is called Birchat HaShevach, Shin Bet Chet. Shin Bet Chet means when we thank Hashem for something wonderful. So for example, if I experience, I go to Niagara Falls, or if I hear a lightning, thunder, and this and that, so that's called a Birchat HaShevach, which means a bracha that we recite to thank Hashem for some unusual, rare, astronomical, or any sort of phenomenon that comes, as a rare kind of experience. So right now, what we're discussing is the first of the four major topics of this Masechet, and that's called Kriyat Shema. Now, keep in mind that a lot of this chapter almost half of the chapter, if not more, is not about Kriyat Shema, but about Birchat Kriyat Shema. And you know that there are brachot that we recite before Kriyat Shema, and then there are brachot that we recite after Kriyat Shema. So that's all part of one package. So the Mishnah begins by asking the question, Me'ematai Korin et Shema Bi'arvin. Now, what we have to know is that Kriyat Shema is a mitzvah that's fulfilled twice within the course of a day, of a 24-hour period, once at night and once during the day. Notice, I mentioned the night first. The reason for that is because in halakha, as opposed to, let's say, secular law, or a mundane secular calendar where the day starts with daybreak and ends the next day. Here in Halacha, the day starts with night. And that's the first question the Mishnah asks. Me'ematai, what is the earliest time? Now, if I would have left out the mem, and it just would have said ematai, then you would be telling me what are the parameters, the bookends, in terms of the clock, in terms of time for Kriyat Shema. But Me'ematai means, the Mem means from when, which means when is the earliest time that night begins such that I can recite Kriyat Shema. Now the word Ba'arvin means in the evening. And there are a number of different possible answers to this question. When does night begin? Now, the classic answer to that question, does anybody know what in halacha when night begins? Classically. Tzeitakovim. Excellent. That's with the stars coming out. However, with regard to Kriyat Shema, we have an exception to the rule. And just to give you a little background, in Kriyat Shema, the Torah never says Balaila. The word Laila, which is the Hebrew word for night, never appears in the context of Kriyat Shema. But rather it says U'bishalbecha, which means when you go to sleep. Now, when does a person go to sleep? So the assumption is that a person goes to sleep at night. Yeah, but when is night? And not only that, it shifts from different seasons of the year. So the Mishnah is actually going to offer a very complex answer to when is the earliest time for Kriyat Shema. And that's called Misha'a, from the time Shahakoanim Nichnasim Lechol B'Trumatam. Okay, the Kohanim receive any of 24 gifts. One of the most profound gifts and most exciting gifts for the Kohen is Truma. And Truma is given from the five species of grains and from Tirosh V'Yitzar, which means from grapes and olives. And what you do is you take a certain percentage of those products, of those produce, and you give it to the Kohen. Jackie, are you a Kohen?
Mm-hmm.
So do I want to give it to you, my Truma?
Sure.
Maybe yes, you're a good guy. Besides being a ginger, I mean, that itself is reason to give it a Truma.
Exactly.
And not only that, it's just great to have you on board. So that's called Tovas Hanot. I'm not going to get into that concept, but Tovas Hanot means the Torah gives me, as the Israel, the option or the rights to decide which Kohen I want to give it to. Now, some people have the philosophy of spread the wealth. So, Jackie, today I'm going to give you my Truma. Next week I'll find a different Kohen. Anybody, any other Kohen in here? No. Okay, so we'll find another Kohen.
Was that important when the Beis HaMikdash was around, if the people didn't trust a certain group of Kohanim?
No. This I don't know. I would assume that when the Beit HaMikdash stood, all the Kohanim were good. They were good. But later on, we don't know exactly who's a Kohen, and it gets more complicated. So now, when will you, as a Kohen, receiving the Truma, when will you come and eat the Truma? So what does it seem from the Mishnah? I don't know exactly, but is it day or night?
Night.
Correct, because we're making an equation now between Kriyat Shema Shel Arvin, which means at night, and the time that the Kohenim are coming in to eat their Truma. So I got news for you. A Kohen could eat his Truma anytime, day or night, 24/7. So what is going on over here? So what's going on over here is we're talking, as Rashi points out on the second line from the top, about Kohenim Shenitma'u. So you want to underline the word Nitma'u in Rashi. Do you see that? Rashi is on, you'll see it on the top right. You see there's a right side and then there's a left side. So on the right side you'll have Rashi. And Rashi says on the second line, Kohanim Shenitma'u. That means they contracted a kind of tumah. Now, and tumah is a hard word to translate into English because it has so many halachic conditions and stipulations and regulations, but we'll call it contamination for lack of a better word. Okay? So now let's say, for example, a Kohen has what's called keri. So you see, now here we're getting way off the topic for tonight, so I don't know how far we should go with this. But in any event, there's a kind of a tumah which a Kohen experiences that requires him one day of tumah. So he's contaminated for one day. During that day, he cannot eat truma. Not only that, he can't even touch the truma, because truma is very holy, and you're not allowed to contaminate Truma. You may know that we wash our hands before we eat bread. Yeah? Why do we... That's called Netilat Yadayim. Why do we do that? Anybody know?
It's I thought it came actually from the Kohanim.
Correct.
The temple.
We're gonna imagine ourselves as if we were Kohanim at the time of the Mikdash. And a Kohen would have to wash his hands before he came in contact with Truma, because otherwise if his hands are Tame, then he would the Truma would contract, would become Tame. So
how is it that he can remove the Truma from only his hands?
Say it again?
How can he remove Truma from only his hands?
Truma?
That's
called Yadayim Shnios L'Tumah, which means that in the laws of Tumah V'Tara, Yadayim has a special category, separate from the rest of the body.
But also, I mean, the reason we during Dachanim, like, we have to shield our eyes is because the Shekinah, like, emanated from their hands as well, right?
But I don't know if that's relevant to this, although you're right, it sounds by association to be very similar. So look, if it helps you remember it, then you should certainly remember it, but in pure strict halachic terms, that has nothing to do with what we're talking about. Now, the Kohen is Tomei for how long in this case? Do you remember my statement?
24.
Exactly, one day. Now, when it comes nighttime, so now two things have to happen. One thing is that the sun has to set. Okay, that's pretty reliable. And the second thing is that the Kohen has to jump into a mikveh. Okay. Now, when is the earliest time that the Kohen is allowed to eat truma? So if you take a look at Rashi that we started, you see where it says Kohenim shenitmu on the second line, that's on your right side. The next word is vitavlu. Vitavlu is a conjugation of a verb, the noun of which is tvila, right? So he dips himself into a mikvah. And then veheriv shimshan. Heriv means it became evening. Shimshan means the sun. And the sun, the evening means that the sun disappears. When the sun disappears below the horizon, that's called Harev Shimshon, otherwise known as Shkiat HaChama. You familiar with these terms?
Shkia.
Shkia means when the sun sets. Okay then? So
why is it Shimshon, like their sun?
That's an excellent question. Harev Shimshon.
Because it also uses that language later on in the Gemara?
Yeah, it's going to come up over and over again. In any event, your question is excellent. I'm not trying to dodge your question. It's just that I want to get everything in order here so we can fit it in. And Rashi says the following. So we now have two conditions. Number one, you can check off Tvila. He went into the mikvah. Yeah? Number two, you can check off Herev Shemshon, which means that the sun is set. Mm-hmm. Vihigia ata lecho b'truma, and now he comes and he eats his truma. So the word ata means now, higia means it's time to eat truma. So now again, I ask my original question: when would therefore be the earliest time to recite Kriyat Shema at night?
Yeah.
Exactly, not Sefer Kochavim, which is what our initial intuitive response would have been, because universally in all of halacha, the night begins with Seita Kochavim, which means when the stars come out. But with regard to Truma, and then by equation Kriyat Shema, the night begins with Herev Shimshon, which means Shkiat HaChama, when the sun sets. Now, how long is it between sunset and Seita Kochavim? Here in Israel, because of the structure of the world, it's usually approximately 18 to 20 minutes. In other parts of the world, it can be a heck of a lot longer. In America, for example, during the summer, it's usually, at least on the East Coast, it's usually about 40 minutes. There are other parts of the world, like Helsinki and other parts, where it's a lot more than that as well. But be that as it may, we don't have to wait until the stars come out. The Mishnah establishes that you could already read Kriyat Shema when the sun sets. Now, why didn't the Mishnah simply say Shkiat HaChama? Why did the Mishnah have to, you know, when you if you were to scratch your right ear, which hand would you use? This is a very important question in Tefillin. I mean, I'm just joking with you. But you would use your right hand, no? Now, if you're scratching your left hand, you'd probably use your left hand. Imagine if I would use my right hand to scratch my left hand. I mean, you could do it, but it's a little bit cumbersome. So why does the Mishnah have to tell me about Kohanim coming in to eat that truma after they were Tomei with Erev Shemesh and after Tefillah in order to tell me when is the earliest time for Kriyat Shema? for God's sakes. Why not just tell me the earliest time for Kriyat Shema is Shkiat HaChama? I mean, that's only two words. Now you should know, the Mishnah is famous for brevity. The Mishnah is very concise, very terse, very stingy on ink. Why is the Mishnah so stingy on ink? Anybody know?
Because it wasn't written, so it had to be...
It wasn't, I need a word before written, it wasn't something to be written, it wasn't permissible to be written, because the Torah says that there are two Torahs, not one Torah. There's the written Torah and there's the oral Torah. The oral Torah has to be transmitted orally. It's not allowed to be committed to writing. Who made the final decision to write the Mishnah, which is against the law? Even before Otzkel, there was life on earth before Otzkel. I mean, again, it's hard to believe. Even before Satsino, right? So that was Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. There's a street over here, right here, a few minutes away from here, called Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi.
I've been to the Beit Shalim where his academy was, where he's, I think he's also buried, where a lot of the Tanaim are buried.
Could be. He was in the north, mostly.
It's near Sepphoris.
It's up in the north. So Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the great prince Rabbi Judah, he made a decision that we have to, listen carefully, violate the law. We have to violate the law, because otherwise Torah is going to be forgotten. It was impossible, given all the situations of exile and the Jews dispersed in so many different countries and the persecutions, it was impossible to maintain the oral tradition. We had to salvage it by writing it down. And, you know, today we talk about poets and different literary figures. The greatest literary figure probably in all of history is Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And again, at my age, I can say this, you know, after lots of experience, it's unbelievable, mind-boggling. I mean, what he's able to accomplish in a Mishnah, it's really amazing. But he tried to be as terse as possible, because he was violating the law. So the less ink you spill, the less you violate the law, if you follow my mashal. In fact, in some cases, what Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi does in the Mishnah is he contradicts himself, so that we'll have to rack our brains and come up with a reconciliation of that contradiction in order to save space. Again, not because he was stingy on ink, I'm using that phrase symbolically, but because we were relying on a very limited kind of permission, a license that would override the law. Because what we're doing is we're undermining the oral tradition. We're really undermining. Every single book that you see in this library is a violation of the law. Did you know that? Every single book. Because all this is Torah, and we're not allowed to write Torah. But it all starts with Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Now, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi sort of opened up the floodgates. And although he was very, very careful about formulating the Mishnah, and if he wanted to accomplish a lot, he would put a lot into a few words. And afterwards, generations gone by, you know, we lowered our guard, so to speak, and now it's just carte blanche. You know, anybody can publish anything. I mean, even I published. Nobody laughed at that joke. But anyway, I always told my father that if you have to laugh at your own jokes, they're not so funny. But
wasn't the worry in part because like it becomes something that is taught and not caught? It gets removed from like the life situation, like from Rob to Talmud. Wasn't that part of the? I mean,
there are a number of different elements, but you're right, Zach. For sure, what's primary on a list is the Rav Talmud relationship. Once you read Torah from a book. You know, gee, if I look at this library here, maybe there are two people here that I've ever met in this whole library, you know, any authors. So obviously I'm totally disconnected from them. I see Rabbi Wein has a few books here. Okay, I know Rabbi Wein. Rabbi Goldscheider, who usually attends our class, if you remember, he's now in Chutzlitz. He published a book that's over there. So I know two or three people, but that's about it. So what kind of connection do I have with those who authored these books?
The guy who sits here?
Yeah, that's Rabbi Goldschild.
Show you.
Aaron, can you help me there? That's it. Yeah, you want to pass it by? That's on Hanukkah.
Oh, cool.
Beautiful cover.
And he dedicated it as a gift to our yeshiva. I think, Sam, if you ask him nicely, he'll give you a copy of the book. Yeah. Okay. I think. I don't know. I shouldn't say it, but he gave me a copy. So Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is now going to accomplish two things at the same time. Do you know the phrase, to kill two birds with one stone? On the one, he's going to teach us laws about truma, and when a Kohen who's taught me is allowed to eat truma. And at the same time, he's going to teach us new laws about Kriyat Shema. But you should know, I'm oversimplifying it, because you could probably fill up about 20 pages worth of literature on why Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi made the analogy in our mission between Kriyat Shema and when the Kohanim were allowed to eat Truma when they became Tomei. So I don't want you to think that I'm giving you the whole, I'm just giving you like the tip of the iceberg. What Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is doing is he's teaching you two different laws from two different areas of Halacha, and he formulates them in one sentence. Now the Mishnah goes on to ask, when is the latest time for Kriyat Shema? Now, if I tell you that the Torah says that when you go to sleep, you know, at that period of time when people are going to sleep, you said, keep in mind, in those days they didn't have electricity. And very often they would go to sleep as soon as it became dark, because otherwise you have to start lighting fires and candles and whatnot. It became an expensive endeavor. So very often, and this is true historically in various geographic locations, when it got dark at night, that's when they went to sleep. But how long did a person sleep? What would you guess?
Let's say if I would take a
census here.
I heard there were
when do you wake up in the morning?
5:30.
Wow, 5:30. Anybody else?
I heard there were six.
Anybody later than six?
Seven. I heard
seven. Okay, so we have 5:30. We're going up to six. We're going up to seven. Anybody that wakes up after seven?
I would say 3 a.m. I heard there were two sleeps.
3 a.m. Oh, but you're really an early riser. You know.
I'm saying in antiquity, I heard there were two sleeps, which is like why David would get up in the middle of the night.
But that's, so Zach, let's try to leave out antiquity for a minute. Just I want to focus your attention on the following. If the Kriyat Shema, the night Kriyat Shema, is at the time period when people are sleeping in their beds, then that should take us through the entire night. Pretty much until daybreak. Again, with the exception of certain individuals who wake up and it's still pitch black out. But most of us will wake up, especially at that time, with daybreak. Now, in fact, that is the law. Kriyat Shema can be recited, I'm talking about the night Kriyat Shema, up to, but not beyond, daybreak. And yet, the Mishnah is not happy about it. Don't wait until daybreak. Because what happens if you wait until daybreak? Almost inevitably, I'm exaggerating, but not by much.
Well, you forget.
You forget. You'll never get around to it. What happens? You know, I tell my wife, her name is Charlie, if you remember, I say, Charm, wait, I have to get a little nap here. You know, I'm really exhausted. Wake me up in a half hour. Now, when I wake up a day later, she says to me, well, I tried to wake you up a half hour and it didn't go. So therefore, what our Mishnah is dealing with, and this is very important, if you learn Gemara, this is going to be the key of keys. And you might want to chart this out. The difference between a Durabanan and a Doraisa. Okay, you may want to chart that out. You let me know if you want me to write this on the board, the whiteboard here, if I can get the right erasers and markers and so forth and so on. There's Do'oraita and Durabona. I mean, if you get that down, I can't begin to tell you how many windows of opportunity that will open for you if you ever want to get heavy into learning Gemara. Do'oraita means a Torah law, and a Durabona means a rabbinic law. And the rabbis were given the mandate called Asus Yagla Torah, which is a Mishnah at the beginning of Avos. And the Mishnah tells us that the Rabbanan have to put a fence around the law. And this Mishnah at the beginning of Shas, the first Mishnah in Shas, gives us a great example of Asus Yagla Torah. Set up a fence. What do I mean by a fence? If I let you get too close, you might fall to the precipice. So I need a fence. And the fence here is going to be, tell me to recite Kriyat Shema early in the evening. Don't wait until it's mid-evening or getting close to daybreak, because I might just not make it. And that's called, in the language of the Mishnah, if you could underline these words, Adsof Hashmura Harishona. You want to underline those words if you have a copy? Adsof Hashmura Harishona. Which means, and Rashi goes through a long discussion about this, the night is divided up into three sections, three divisions. And each one of these three divisions is called an Ashmora, literally translated as a watch. In other words, they used to have watchmen who took the first shift, and then, you know, like in medicine, you have what's called emergency medicine. So you have physicians in emergency medicine take the first shift, and then there's the second shift, and finally there's the third shift. So this statement that the latest time for Kriyat Shema Shel Arvis is at the end, at Sof, Ashmur Rishona, the first of the three shifts. So let's say, for example, I'm just giving you an example here at the top of my head. Let's say that nighttime starts at 9 o'clock and then daybreak starts, you know, breaks out at 9 a.m. So you have 12 hours. So we're going to divide up. Okay, 12. Yeah, we're going to divide up the 12 hours into three equal parts. That's how many hours each? 4 hours each. So basically, according to Rabbi Eliezer, what would be the latest time for Kriyat Shema Shel Arvis if 9 o'clock is the earliest time for Kriyat Shema Shel Arvis? Nobody followed me?
I didn't.
Let me go one more time. So the night begins at 9. I'm just giving you a hypothetical case. And daybreak begins at 9. So you have 12 full hours. So you're going to divide it into three parts. And Rabbi Lozer wants it finished. You want to recite Kriyat Shema no later than the end of the first of these three parts.
Until 1 a.m.
Exactly, till 1 a.m. Right? So you go from 9 to 1. You got those 4 hours. And you got to recite Kriyat Shema within those 4 hours. V'chachamim omrim. However, the rabbis didn't go that far. They felt that was too strict. And they gave you a little bit more leeway. Ad chatzot. Up until midnight. Now again, in this case, midnight is actually earlier than 1 a.m., okay? But at least what we gain by calling it midnight is that it's a definite set time. You know, everybody relates to midnight. And that's when we're going to do it. Now, in a normal situation, I gave you sort of an unnormal situation, nighttime would probably begin at around 7. Now, if you add 5 hours to 7 to get to midnight, that's more than 4 hours. Do you follow? So, you know, if you're dividing the night into three parts, then the end of the first part is going to probably be before midnight. I mean, my numbers didn't work out so well. But let's say if it would be 7 to 7, right? 7 to 7, night starts at 7 and day breaks out at 7. So now you're going to add 4 hours to 7 and you end up at 11 p.m. So that's going to be Rabbi Eliezer. And Chacham are going to say, I'm going to give you that extra hour up until midnight. Rabbi Gamliel Omer Ad She'aleh Amud HaShachar. Rabbi Gamliel is the most lenient of the three. He's going to give you an even extended period of time. Ad until She'aleh Amud HaShachar. Until the morning star rises. Meaning when it shows up, the morning star. Now keep in mind, the morning star, the Amud HaShachar, is quite a bit before what we call Hanetz. Hanetz is when the sun actually shows up on the horizon. So there's an Amud HaShachar. Let's say, for argument's sake, that Amud HaShachar is 1 hour before Hanetz. Hanetz means daybreak, before the sun appears on the eastern horizon. And now you have an extra hour. I'm sorry, the opposite is true. You have to cut down by an hour, right? Because the latest time is going to be Amud HaShachar. And that's even in the most liberal of all the three shittot, which is the opinion of Rabbi Gamliel. Rabbi Gamliel wants to give you even a longer period of time. But yet, although he's giving you a longer period of time, he insists that you have to finish up before She'aleh Amud HaShachar. Now, normally, Amud HaShachar, because it's so long before the sun rises, that's part of the nighttime. Part of the nighttime. But here, he says, we're talking not about night and day, we're talking about sleeping and waking up. So since the Torah says when the time that you sleep, that's for Kriyat Shema Shel Arvis, and then the time that you're awake, that's for Kriyat Shema Shel Shachris. And therefore, he says, by Amud HaShachar, people are already waking up. Like, for example, you know that the first of the Berchot HaShach that we recite in the morning is Asher Natan LaSachvivina, which means that the cock crows, or how would you say it in English? You know, cockle doodle doo.
Yeah. So, the cock ability to distinguish between day and night.
Day and night. So, for example, I very often walk from Har Nof, where I live, over here to Katamon on a Shabbat, and I will actually hear I will hear as I'm walking the cockle doodle do. I don't know if you ever heard of it. It's quite early.
Really?
Yeah. And at that point, I should be making the bracha, but Chazal say you can make all the brachot together at the same time. So let's go over the three opinions. The most strict opinion would require that you recite Kriyat Shema Shel Arvis no later than Sof Ashmura Harishona. That's Rabbi Eliezer. Do you have that? So that means you divide the night into three parts. By the end of the first of the three parts, which is called Ashmura Harishona, by then you would have had to say recite Kriyat Shema. Okay then? Sam, are you with me? You look a little tired today. Mm-hmm. Okay, see if you can hang in there with me. Okay, so that's according to Rabbi Eliezer. Then we shift over to the Chachamim, and they give you a little bit more time. Until what? Chatzot. They'll give you until midnight. Then we have the third shita, the third opinion, and that's the most liberal of all the opinions. That's Rabbi Gamliel. He allows you to go all the way till Amud HaShachar. Now the Mishnah tells a story. Who likes stories? Okay, I tried to tell you stories about Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, but you didn't like that. So, but hopefully this story in the Mishnah you'll like. And the Mishnah says the following. Maisa means a story. Ubo banav mi beit ha-mishteh. The children of Rabbi Gamliel came home from a party. Some of the commentaries say it was a wedding. And they came late. Arulo. And they said to Rabbi Gamliel, to their dad, "Hey dad, lo karinu et shema." Right? If you come back from a wedding, what's the first thing you're going to tell your father? First thing, "Oh, I didn't recite Kriyat Shema," right? I'm just kidding with you. I mean, it's like interesting. Amar lehem. So Rabbi Gamliel responded, "Im lo alav mura shachar, if the sun, you know, the morning star has not yet risen, chayavim atem likrot. You're required to read Kriyat Shema." Why? Because Rav Gamliel holds that what's the latest time for Kriyat Shema Shel Arvit? Mishialeh Amud HaShachar. So therefore he was basically telling them, you know, he not only was he, you know, did he preach, but he practiced what he preached. And he told them this is exactly what you want to do. And then he says, "Velozu bilvad amru," and not only this, I want to tell you what they said. Ella, they said the following: "Kol mashamru chachamim." Whenever the chachamim say ad chatzot, which was the opinion of the chachamim in our Mishnah, mitzvatan ad sheyale amud hashachar. That really the mitzvah is throughout the night. And the reason why the Chachamim are going to tell you to finish up by Chatzot, by midnight, is because they're afraid that if you delay too long, you'll miss it entirely. So let's give a few examples of, and these examples come from Kachim, from the Beit HaMikdash, where the Chachamim say you have to finish up by midnight. The first is called Hekter Chalovim Veivarim. Now watch this. When you bring a carbon on the Mizbeach, then there are certain parts of the animal which are left on the Mizbeach and they will burn through the night. And those are called chalavim ve'evarim. Chalavim means certain fats of the animal, and evarim are certain limbs of the animal. Again, if we were learning kachim, we'd have to spend a lot of time figuring out which korbanot have which parts that need hekter. The hekter means they burn on the mizbeah. And mitzvatan ad sheyaleh amud hashachar. Again, we're going to tell you to make sure that you burn these chalavim ve'evarim by midnight, by chatzot. But really, says Rav Gamliel, I'll tell you the honest truth. You don't have to finish it by Chatzot. You have to finish it by Amud HaShachar, a full 4 or 5 hours later. But we're going to tell you, finish it up by Chatzot, by midnight, because otherwise we're afraid you'll never get around to do it. Here's another example. Kol HaNechalim Liyom Echad Mitzvatan Ad Shealeh Amud HaShachar. You know that in Kodshim, in Korbanot, parts of the animal are eaten. Who eats those parts of the animal, the meat of the animal?
The Kohanim and their family.
Oh, so it's the Kohanim, and that's called Kodshe Kodshim, and then there's something called Kodshim Kalim, that's where the Yisrael, the non-Kohen, who brought the Korban, he's allowed to eat it. Now, every every karban, that's that the meat of which is eaten, has a specific limited allotment of time. So I can't leave the meat till tomorrow. I have to eat it today. That's urgent. Otherwise, if I leave it till tomorrow, it becomes something called notar. We won't get into that. So the law is that if they give me the you know till tomorrow to eat the basar kachir, I can eat it until the morning star appears on the horizon. Now when Cain, so Rav Gamliel asks himself a rhetorical question, Lama amru chachamim achatzot? So why the chachamim tell me finish it up by chatzot? Read Kriyat Shema by chatzot. Be matir chalavim veivarim by chatzot. Eat the basar kodshim by chatzot. Why? If you're giving me all the way another 4 or 5 hours until Avodah Shachar, why do you mislead me and telling me ad chatzot that the limitation is midnight? Kidei la'achik adam min aveira. That they want to make sure that you're far, far away from violating the law. Meaning, the law is that you have to eat it before Amudah Shachar. But we're afraid, if we allow you to postpone it and delay it and sleep and whatever you'll do during the night, you get preoccupied and distracted, then you will violate an Avera and you won't fulfill your obligation. So let me ask you a question. If, let's say I get back from a party, and a wedding, whatever it might be, and it's after Chatzot, and I haven't recited Kriyat Shema yet. So what would Rav Galil tell me? Recite Kriyat Shema. I, the Chachamim, say Ad Chatzot, it's after midnight already. I got back after midnight. And Rabbi Lezer says, I got to get back by 11 o'clock, we said. The Sof HaShmur Rishona. And the Chachamim are more liberal, they say, by Chatzot. But it's after Chatzot, what should I do? So Rav Gamliel says, you know what? When the Chachamim told you to make sure to recite Kriyat Shema by Chatzot by midnight, what they really meant is, La'archik et Adam min Havera. They wanted to keep you away from being negligent and criminally leaving out Kriyat Shema. So therefore they told you, make sure you finish up by Chatzot. But now I'm in a no-win situation, it's after Chatzot. I came back from the wedding and banged myself on the head and I didn't go to Dav Ma'ariv yet, I didn't say Kriyat Shema yet, what should I do? Says Rav Gamliel, now we're going to go back to the main law. The main law is that we give you up until daybreak.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
So when I remember first reading this several years ago, I had the idea, like the Das Torah, that maybe the reason that Rav is comparing these two also is because of Yochanan ben Zakkai, that basically that prayer is sort of in place of Korban.
Right.
And so that maybe that's why he's creating this parallelism, because the Beis HaMikdash wasn't standing when this was written. So it's not as necessarily, not that it's not relevant, but not as chronologically relevant to when it was written, but that because the brachot, and because the Shema is so important, that it's likened and there's a parallelism to the actual korbanot.
So I'll tell you the truth. You're right, but only half right.
Okay.
In my humble opinion.
Okay.
You're right, but if we were talking about tefillah, about prayer, and we would set up a law in prayer in terms of the restriction of time that would parallel the Beit HaMikdash and the Korbanot, you would be right. Because tefillah, prayer, replaces the Korbanot. That's what we have today.
Yeah.
But our subject is not tefillah, is not prayer. That'll come up later on in the fourth chapter of Brachot. But in the first chapter of Brachot, we're solely, exclusively dedicated to Kriyat Shema. Kriyat Shema is not in any way a replacement for Korbanot. And therefore the laws of time, the timing and the restrictions in time are independent of Korbanot.
It's a direct mitzvah that they had in the time of the Beis HaMikdash that they were following. So
were they also reciting Shema with these Korbanot as well? I
mean, sure, why, absolutely.
Okay. And we're going to see actually the reasons for Kriyat Shema in the Daf, that when the person is having the watch and it's clearly something that definitely existed in the time of the temple and in the time before maybe.
Because Kriyat Shema is not dependent upon the Beit HaMikdash.
I wasn't saying it was dependent.
Or nor is it a replacement for the Beit HaMikdash. So we get to prayer, then we're going to see amazing, amazing parallels between prayer and Karbanot. Here, the Mishnah quotes Karbanot for only one reason. The Mishnah wants to illustrate, that's from Gamliel's point, that whenever they tell you, especially in Karbanot, which are very time-bound mitzvah, that you should finish up by Chatzot, what they really meant is that they want to be marchik you min avera, and therefore they make this siag, as we said, a fence around the Torah, but the mitzvah continues through the night.
Because there was so lachmir in the temple because of the Kedusha, that's why.
In the temple we had to be very mach. I mean, if you don't eat the basar karba within its time allotment, it becomes nosa. And if you eat nosa, that's karis. I mean, that's like a cutoff. You know? So let's see what we can do in the next, I don't know how long we can stay, another 10, 15 minutes, if we get a little dip into the Gemara itself. The Gemara says the following. Tana. Now, at this point, I just want to give you the basics, because once again, we're dealing with beginning learning. I'm not assuming that you're all scholars, although I see that you are scholars, but just in case, you know, you're not all scholars, there are Tanoim, and then there are Moron. Right? The Tanoim lived at the time of the Mishnah or before the Mishnah. And then, let's say the last Tana was, let's assume, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. So he closes the period of Tanoim. And again, the art school, I think, has a table where you can see exactly, you know, what year BCE this is. I don't know by heart. I can look it up for you. And at that point, we make a shift, a transition from Tanoim to Amoraim. So when we deal with our Mishnah, and for example, our Mishnah opens with an anonymous question. When I say anonymous, there's no name. It doesn't say Omar Rav somebody may Amatai Korin and Shma B'Arvin. So if no name is mentioned, that's called a Tana. Tana means, you know, one of the Tanoim. We don't know exactly who he is. Then we get to Hecha, where. Hecha is Aramaic for where. Again, if you're keeping a list of words, this is a great word to write down. Not a concept or a method, but or a structure. It's a word. And that's called Hecha. Hecha means where. Kai. Kai means he's standing. Where is the Tana standing? What does that mean, where is the Tana standing? Who cares where he's standing?
His opinion?
No. What it means is, listen carefully, Jackie, Tana Hechakoi means you don't ask a question unless that question is a result of some previous statement. Do you understand what I mean? In other words, if I came to you and I asked you, well, when do I sign up for the, what's the program, Zach, next week? What's it called?
It's the leadership.
When do I sign up for the leadership program? Does that make sense? Does that make sense if I ask you, when do you sign up? When's the deadline for signing up for the leadership program? Why doesn't that make sense?
Because you're not part of the program.
Okay, let's say I was part of the program.
Yeah.
Okay. This is my great aspiration to be part of your program. You'll invite me. You know, I can pay you a couple of $1 million to become part of the
review your file.
No, but again, logically, what's missing here if I ask you, when is the latest time?
Context.
Exactly. First, tell me that there's a leadership conference.
Yeah.
Then tell me, well, the leadership conference, you could read about it, you know, on the big board. You know, I got a WhatsApp. I don't know what. I got some sort of Google about the leadership content. Then I'm going to ask you, well, when is the latest time to sign up for it? But I can't just tap you on the back and say to you in the middle of Rabbi Yochum and Zakai Street, I'm going to say to you, hey, when is the last time to sign up for this thing? Like, you know, like, you know, you're looking at me like an idiot.
Which thing?
What thing? Where thing? Why, you know, you didn't tell me anything. So you ask me, Meimatai Korinit Shema V'Arvus. So you're assuming that I know that there's some entity called Kriyat Shema. You're assuming that I know there's a Kriyat Shema at night. Like, you know, give it a break. That's called Tana Hechakoi. And you will see these three words as a phrase all over the place. You know, almost every other Mishnah, you'll see the Gemara is going to ask Tana Hechakoi, which literally translates, but it's an idiomatic phrase, where is the Tana standing? Like, where is he? You know, he's in the middle of nowhere. He must have had some sort of a, Aaron used the word context, I like that word context.
And why do you, Tana Hechakoi?
Tana, the Tana, Hecha, where, Koi, is he standing? Where is the Tana standing? The Katani, it says in the Mishnah, quote, Me'ematai. You know, from when? What do you mean from when? Tell me first that there's some sort of obligation. Vitu means and furthermore. So whenever you see the word vitu, it means the Gemara is adding a second question. You know, we're adding fuel to the flame over here. Maishna, what's the difference? Ditani be arvis baresha. Listening to shachris baresha. Maishna means, this is very odd. Maishna means, like, this is different. You know, it's unusual. You ever meet a person and you say to yourself, this guy is unusual. You know, like, I thought I knew everybody at every time, but no, this guy is like, there's something very unusual here. Ditani, the writer says, be arvis at the nighttime, baresha. Listni is a conjugation, a verb of the word tana. Tana means to teach. Listni, it should have taught us the shachris, baresha. Resha means at the beginning. Why not start with shachris? Now again, we're going to have to analyze why the Gemara thinks we should start with shachris after I told you when we started this Mishnah that in halachic terms, the day begins at night. So for some reason, the Gemara thinks that in this case, it would have been more appropriate to start with the daytime. So that has to be ironed out. Why the Gemara thinks we should start with the daytime. Here I have a footnote in my particular Gemara, and he says, Madua, why was it poshut? Why was it simple to the Gemara in its question that the Tana should have started with the daytime? So he answers here, that, just one second, he says that most of our mitzvot, right, we have 613 mitzvot, so most of them begin by day. There are rare exceptions. Right, I can give you a long list of mitzvot that commence by day. A very short list of mitzvot that commence at night. Pretty soon we're going to have a few of them. On the night of Pesach, we're going to have the mitzvah of matzah. After the second night, we'll have the mitzvah of Sfirat HaOmer, which is at night. But again, those are the exceptions. Most of the mitzvot are during the day. So there must be some pressing reason why he would start with the nighttime. So the Gemara answers, Tana, the author of our Mishnah, Akra Kai. Kai again means he's standing. Or he's holding. In other words, to use Aaron's word, Kai means the context. Akra. What does Akra mean? So you get... See, here's where Aramaic throws us off. Because in Aramaic, they add an aleph to the beginning of the word. And that's a conjugation. But if you leave out the word aleph, what word do you have? Kra. Okay, Kra means a verse in the Torah. In fact, if I tell you to read verses in the Torah, I'm telling you to read Mikra, with a mem at the beginning. But Kra is the noun that describes a verse in the Torah. Akra means related to a Kra. So the Aleph is a conjugation that means related to.
Like related.
Let me just think in English.
Related to a reading, kind of?
You know, what would you use as a conjugation? Just let me think. If I wanted to say... I don't know, maybe in different languages, it could be in other languages, it's more pronounced. In English, I don't know if there's a prefix. Is there such thing as a prefix which means on something?
In. N.
N? Just an N at the beginning of a word?
E-N, E-N or N. It's a different word, though.
Yeah. E-N? Like, give me a word that starts with
entrapment.
Entrapment.
Like sir.
There are examples where you have it. It doesn't exist in every word, but if you're talking about a prefix, yes. But yeah.
Mm. I'm not sure if that's
encompass,
what I'm looking
for. Encompass, yeah.
What's the opposite of sub talk? Like, it's sir, right? Sub, sir. Like, you don't know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Sub-terfuge. Like, yeah, sub's below.
No.
You mean like an overarching concept? You mean as opposed to a sub-concept?
Right. Sub-concept.
Like a paradigm?
No, you have like subcutaneous tissue, right. And then you don't have circutaneous tissue, but you know what sir, yeah. The prefix sir.
Right.
Yeah.
All right.
Surreptitious.
Anyway, so where is this Tana coming from?
Oh, okay.
He's coming from, everybody, Krah, what's Krah? A verse in the Torah. Now, it makes sense that the Mishnah is to be understood in the context of a verse in the Torah. Because the Torah itself was called what?
Mikra.
Mikra, otherwise known as, in the long form, Torah Shebichtav. The Mishnah's Torah Shebalpeh. So the Torah Shebalpeh should be linked up, or shall be a continuity of the Torah Shebichtav. So that's called Tana Akra Koi. The Tana is holding in a verse in the Torah. Which verse in the Torah? Dichtiv. Now, whenever you see the word Dichtiv as it says, and now you want to know where that verse is, so for that, you check out something called Torah R. Now, I'm not sure if in the art school they have the Torah R. Do you have the Torah R? It's on the right side. Torah R or Torah R HaShalem?
Yes,
you have such a thing?
Torah HaShalem.
Oh, so you see the little Aleph there before the first one?
Yeah.
He's going to tell you now the entire verse, because sometimes the Gemara only quotes part of the verse. You want to see the whole verse in context. And at the end of the quote, he's going to tell you where to find it. So you'll see it says here, this should be familiar to you. It says, Vishinantam levanecha v'dibartam bom b'shivtecha b'veitecha u'v'lechecha b'aderech. But here we get to the punchline. When you go to sleep and when you wake up. This was the verse that the Tana is kind of attaching to. And this is how we have to understand that Mishnah. Zman, the time for Kriyat Shema, Dishkiva. Shkiva means when we're sleeping, which says Bishalbacha. Emat, when does it begin? How does the halacha define the time that we're sleeping? The beginning of it, then we'll get to the end of it, right? It's bookends. So the answer is Mishaasha Kohanim Nichnasim Lechol B'Trumatam. So we've now answered two questions. Let's go over the two questions. First of all, it sounds a little bit idiosyncratic to ask somebody, Me'ematai, you know, from what time do you begin when you haven't even told me that there's an obligation? And secondly, why do you begin at night? Why not begin like most mitzvot, which are by day? So we've now answered, we've killed two birds with one stone. Number one, by quoting the verse in B'Shalbach of Kumecha in Sefer Dvarim, and that you'll see here in chapter 6, then we know that there's a context here. In other words, the context is, you read this pasuk, this verse, and it says, B'Shalbach u'B'Kumecha. So now tell me, when is the earliest time for B'Shalbach? Second question was, why does he start at night and not on day? The answer is because it says B'Shalbacha and then it says B'Kumecha. Ibayit Emo. Okay, now this you have to write down. Because again, if you're not familiar with the Talmudic jargon, Jackie, you're listening to me, this is mamish, something that will appear, if not on every page once, then on every page three times. I don't know how long. You can do it. Now they have computers, so you can actually do a word search. Ve'i boit emo. You want to write that down, or at least write a translation on top of it? Ve'i boit emo. Now I'm going to give you the literal translation, because like all phrases in the Talmud, there's a literal translation, but there's also the idiomatic phrase, and then there's the more, you know, the flexible, the more poetic meaning of it. Ve'i, and if, boit, you would like, ema, I will tell you. So let's read it. If you would like, I'll tell you. So what does it mean, if you would like, I'll tell you?
You can interpret it a different way.
I would offer you another answer. If you'd like, I'll give you a second answer. Now, whenever you see that, you have to rack your brains and figure out, why did he feel compelled to offer another answer? Was there some hole in the first answer? And then you're going to have to ask yourself another question. Well, once you have the second answer, why did you need the first answer? That's why we go to yeshiva to learn about all these things, because they're very profound. V'ibayit eim, I'll give you another alternative answer to your questions. Yolif means he's deriving it from, Yolif means he's deriving it from, Mibriyato Shel Olam, from the creation of the world. Dichtiv, because the pasuk says in the beginning of creation, Vayehi Erev, Vayehi Boker, Yom Echad. There was night, and there was day, and there was one day. So my friends, in sequence, what came first? The night or the day?
Night.
The night came first. So the Tana of our Mishnah, because again, we want to see some sort of linkage between the written Torah and the oral Torah, so he deliberately follows the pattern or mirror images the verse in the Torah Shemachtav in the written Torah. And since the verse begins with Erev, and then it goes on to Boker, therefore, the Tana of our Mishnah starts with the night. Now, the commentaries point out that this Ibois Ema, the second answer, only really addresses the second question. Why did you start with night rather than day? It doesn't really address the first question, Tana Hechakoi, like where was the Tana standing? So the commentaries say that the first question was answered, and that wasn't, there was no hole, so to speak, no deficiency in the first question, in the answer to the first question, namely, the Tana is learning the Pasuk B'Shalbucha of Kumecha. So that's it. And the second answer is just coming as an alternative to know why the Tana begins with the Kriyat Shema at night, and not, like other mitzvot, with the daytime, and the answer is because we're going to derive it from Briyato Shel Olam. Now the obvious question is, what does Briyato Shel Olam have to do with Kriyat Shema? God created time, and the first period of time was the night, that's called Vayerev, and then he created the second period of time, which is day. I mean, that's very nice and dandy, but what does it have to do with Kriyat Shema? This is supposed to explain why the Tana of our Mishnah began with Kriyat Shema Shel Arvis. So that's going to be a major issue in understanding the Gemara.
That question?
I don't know. It's possible, but we're going to have to be patient.
Yeah.
We're going to have to be patient for that. Okay, now what I need at this moment is feedback. Because if you want me to, you know, take this on as a weekly project, I need a lot of answers to a lot of questions. So let me just throw out a bunch of questions. Question number one, am I going too fast? Am I going too slow? Question number two, should I be writing more things on the blackboard? Should I less no things on the blackboard? Question number three, do you want to continue learning Gemara? Do you want to learn this Gemara, a different Gemara? Question number four, when do you want to meet? Because we used to meet on Mondays at 5. And I don't know if that's good for you. Now, last week it was my fault that I couldn't make it at 5. I had a wedding. But this week, it was your fault that you couldn't make it on Monday. I don't mean fault in the sense of, you know, don't misunderstand me. I don't mean a judgmental fault. But I'm saying, those are the questions that I want to ask you. So let me start with the first question. Is this a little bit, a lot of what you wanted, that you had in mind by Gemara? Feel free. This is not a time to be inhibited.
So when we studied the Daf, we got together and studied Daf Michon and Aaron the other day.
You and Aaron were learning this stuff together?
Yeah, and we actually didn't even touch the Rashi. That was like a new aspect. So I guess in the future, I think if we do this again, we're gonna have to make sure that we pay attention to everything.
My question leads to another question. Do you want to learn Rashi? You know, we can say to ourselves, let's leave out Rashi.
Well,
you know, that's
really,
more advanced.
Understand, you know, a lot better.
So in a general sense, Mike, the question I'm throwing out to you is, do you want to do it at a more fast pace, more superficial, leave out the Rashis, leave out the concepts, you know, just plow through the Gemara? Do you appreciate that we try to broaden the horizons, do a little bit of Rashi, not too much Rashi, but to try to analyze and enhance our understanding?
I like going a little bit deeper into it.
Me too.
Me too.
I think what might facilitate maybe going as quickly might be, maybe we can help prepare just like a glossary. Like, I know there are a lot of glossaries.
Yeah, there's an excellent book. I wonder if... I'm sure we have
so
it.
So that way you don't have to explain it, and we can like...
Yeah, so the book, you have to write this down.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you now a hint. No, that's not the word I'm looking for. I'm going to give you a recommendation.
Does the JSTOR also help? Like, if we...
I'm going to give you a hint here that's worth $1 million.
Okay.
If you really want to learn Gemara.
Yeah.
Okay? Write this down. Rabbi Frank, F-R-A-N-K. His first name is Yitzchak. And he authored a book called Talmudic Dictionary. I think I'm missing one word. It's something. Anyway, I'll try to find it for you. If you have 5 minutes, I'll look around. And if not,
the olive on it.
Rainbow
colored olive.
Yeah, that sounds
it's
right.
It's like a glossary, Talmudic something.
Yeah, Talmudic phrases, mm-hmm. and it's beautiful because the man, I happen to know him personally, he spent 14 years of his life on this book.
Wow.
It's a book that's even thinner than this. It's just an amazing treasure house for those who want to begin learning Gemara. So, for example, Tana Hechakoi. I have no doubt that he'll give you half a page on Tana Hechakoi or on the Ebi's Ema that we covered before. And he'll give you other sources. Everything is translated into beautiful, clear English, and it's wonderful. That's Rabbi Yitzchak Frank. Okay, I'm sure it's either in this room or in the other room. I have my own copy, which I can bring to you, and you can even borrow it and, you know, give it back to me.
So maybe we can photocopy if there are relevant glossary terms for the...
Well, again, what you'll have to do is, because I don't know if I can do this work for you, you'll have to decide which words you want to look up in his Talmudic dictionary,
right,
and then photocopy those pages. If you get to a bookstore, just buy it for yourself. I mean, it's going to be the... If you're at all interested in Gemara, it's the best investment you'll ever make. It'll cost you $10 or $20. It's not going to... I don't think it'll throw... put you in the poorhouse. It's an incredible piece of research. He worked on it, as I told you, for a yom of a laila, day and night. Or maybe we should say laila of a yom. Okay,
I should anyway. He has my mother's maiden name, so I'm, you
know. Good. Very good. So, Rabbi Yitzchak Frank, lovely guy. I wonder if he's still teaching. Yeah.
So
that's something. Yeah, go ahead, Colin.
The intention for this class, just discussing with the others, was that we would try to at least do an entire Amud in one class. So I thought that we should prepare it beforehand, go through the Aramaic ourselves and try to get a good grasp of it, so that in class we can complete the entire Amud and maybe have learned some Rashi on the side in the class.
Okay, great. Excellent. So that's then. So I think I have a little bit of a, shall I say, a glimpse of what gentlemen you'd like to do, which I didn't have when I started. You know, I had no clue. I was just like groping in the dark. That's number one. Then we got to talk about the timing. Now, Jackie, maybe this is more of a private discussion between me and you, but you had mentioned the possibility that we don't drop Musar. Maybe we could fit in Musar at a different time. So we'll research that together. Yeah.
I was going to recruit more people in case these guys.
Right. If any of you guys want to continue in Musar, we pretty much finished with the Altar of Kelm, and now I'd like to move on. And the two major movements in Musar that I'd love to get to is Navardik, which was really way out. That was pretty radical. And Slabodka. And Slabodka is really where the Musar movement is at. You know, the last century. You know, they just completely took over. I don't know if there's one person on the... Well, I know of one person, but... And there aren't more than one or two people on the face of the earth who follow the Navardika, Musar, there. But Slabodka is still very much involved. So again, I don't know, you know, it's... There's another issue that Zach mentioned, you know, Masa is asking you to do a lot of things towards the end of the year. So I don't expect you to have that time. But I'm just throwing it out there. Jack, you'll tell me if you want to do that. Now, if we're not going to learn Musa, then Jackie, I'd love you to take your volumes, because otherwise I'm always afraid it could get lost. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's underneath my seat. If you know where I mean, I'll point it out to you after we finish.
I would still like to learn Musa also.
Okay, so that's the question. You know, we can't do everything if you don't have the time. I'm making myself available. I have a pretty busy schedule, but for you guys, I'm willing to try to be flexible.
So I think
you know, if you're ever interested in coming to my house in Har Nof, I don't mean the house that you know about here, then I'm very flexible in Har Nof. And we have Baruch Hashem, we have a beautiful living room, and I have a
What's the difference between the house here and the house in Har Nof?
I mean, let me put it to you this way. The house here would fit into the porch in Har Nof. Is that giving you a little bit of a taste?
I don't know.
But it's much more than that. I mean, we have seven bedrooms in Har Nof. They say just bedrooms, I'm talking about. And we have a gigantic living room, which is almost the size of this space measures. So if you're ever interested, you know, please take me up on that. You know, and then I'm totally pressureless. I can put on my straw hat. I'm just at home. You know what I'm saying? Here it's a little bit more, you know, I'm on spilkes, as they say. I'm sitting on pins, you know. But there, I'm a different person. So anyway, so that's number one. So if you want to learn Musar, gather together your troops and let me know when is a good time, if it could work into your schedule. It doesn't have to be at 4 o'clock. It doesn't have to be at 5 o'clock. I can try to bend my schedule. If it's in Har Nof, if anybody wants to, you know, a cab to Har Nof will cost you 45 shekels.
How far away is it by bus? You know,
the bus is a schlep. Yeah, I think I don't know. I'm not familiar with the buses, but I'm not even sure if you can get to Har Nof with one bus. I think you might have to change buses. I think it's like a 74 or something, and then you get on another bus. You know, in your schedule, because I know a little bit about your schedule, it's Zelozev. But if you get
Har Nof from Ramot on the way back,
yeah. So I'm just saying, if you can get together a couple of guys, or the ladies want to join us, you know, I can ask my wife to put out cookies and tea, you know. But I'm just saying that if you get together four or five people for a cab here, it's bufkis. It's little. It's a very small amount of money. It'll probably cost you, the whole night will cost you like 20 shekels. So if we feed you enough that it makes it worth it for 20 shekels, you say, you might end up making a profit on the deal. But the last question that I want to ask you is this class, if we're shifting to Gemara and we'll try to do the whole Amud with a couple of Rashis and so forth and so on, then when are we meeting?
I would prefer personally that we go back to Monday with this class.
Monday at 5?
Yeah.
Okay, how many people can make it at Monday at 5? As a general rule, again, next week might be the exception.
Yeah, generally.
So last Tuesdays, both of us had a thing, like a special thing. So Mondays in general.
So 1 second. So Zach says that next Monday he is on the leadership program. Yeah. Now, what would be the earliest? Do you know, Zach, what would be the earliest time you can make it?
I think the schedule, I have a schedule here, but I don't know how far away Neve Elon is.
How are you getting from Neve Elon? Neve Elon by car is 15 minutes from Yerushalayim. But I don't know, if you go by public transportation, it's a whole other story.
I mean, for the night, I might be willing to